Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us on History FM Radio on liveparanormal.com and history.fm. From paranormal to the unexplained history, it all happens here. Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in live interactive chat 24/7 with our radio show hosts and other like-minded people on www.liveparanormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by full interactive media. Stop by now and join in on the fun.
Good evening, and welcome to episode number 11 of Search for Hidden Beasts here on liveparanormal.com. As always, I am your humble and obedient host, Ken Gerhard, and for the next 50 minutes or so, we will be discussing everything having to do with the science, the field of cryptozoology, which is the study of elusive, unverified animal species. And we talk about all kinds of cool topics on the show, ranging, of course, from the big hairy one, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Yeti, etc., to lake monsters, to winged creatures, werewolves, you name it. We talk about it here. And as always, those of you in the chat room are invited to chime in if you have any questions or comments for the guest. Real excited about the next guest that I have on. But before I bring him on, I just wanted to introduce a new segment this week, and I'm going to keep it brief, but basically I wanted to do a thing called Today in Cryptozoology, where I mention a notable event on this date in the past that may have some bearing, some significance to what we do here. So today, in fact, is the birthday, I'm finding out, of Smokey Crabtree. And for those of you out there who are fans of the movie and the story of the legend of Boggy Creek, the Fauk monster of Arkansas, you will be, of course, familiar with Smokey. Smokey was pretty much the centerpiece of that whole story. In fact, his son Lynn had perhaps the most harrowing encounter with the Fauk monster, was chased by the Fauk monster through the woods near Fauk, Arkansas. And Smokey, in fact, discovered the first tracks left by the Fauk monster, which apparently had only three toes. And much of the movie was filmed on his property. Smokey, is, as it turns out, was a little bit was kind of screwed by the I don't know if he's sorry to be so blunt. He was kind of screwed by the producers of that film, and subsequently didn't really make any money or royalties. He has written a couple of books, and I understand that Smokey is 83 years old today. He's quite a character, if you've ever met him, and those of us who are into Southern Bigfoot research really have the highest regard for Smokey Crabtree. So happy birthday, Smokey. I just wanted to give you a shout-out. Okay, so we got that out of the way. Now I'd like to bring on my guest. I'm really excited to have him on, and I'll tell you why. One of my main intents on doing this show is to bring on investigators and researchers that perhaps don't get the notoriety that they deserve. And I think that Andrew definitely qualifies for that. He and I have been corresponding for a while now. Andrew is a tireless researcher, very knowledgeable, and really does some outstanding work and delves into some of these lesser-known cryptids that people aren't really familiar with. He's based in Pennsylvania, Lancaster specifically, and he's also familiar with the Maryland area. And in fact, he is the CFZ Center for Fortean Zoology. He is the representative for both the states of Pennsylvania and Maryland. Let's see, here's his bio. He's been researching various aspects of cryptozoology for over 20 years now. He's written three articles for the now-defunct Cryptozoology Review, and his new book, Mysterious Pennsylvania, is due to be released very shortly. That should be a good read. He's currently working on a follow-up book centered on the state of Maryland. So that being said, I'd like to bring him on, ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Gable. Andrew, are you there this evening?
Yep.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm really anxious to talk about some of these really cool cryptids that you've investigated, and by all means, anything else that we happen to stumble upon. Andrew, I'd like to start out, by asking you, how you became involved in the field, or I guess why you became involved in the field of cryptozoology. Give us some backstory here. What is it that compels a person like you to become immersed in this really weird subject matter?
I think it really goes back to when I was a kid, because I was always into monsters and dinosaurs and mythology and all kind of stuff like that. And when I was, I don't know how old I was, like 5 or 6 or something, I remember this book that had, was mainly a list of different mythical monsters, but it also had Bigfoot and the Abominable Snowman and sea serpents and Loch Ness Monster and things like that that are, cryptozoology. And I really was fascinated with the idea that, people actually claim to be seeing some of these quote-unquote mythical monsters. So that's pretty much what I think is probably the main impetus for it. Also, there's a big influence from my grandfather, because he's very avid hunter and fisherman and everything, and he always tells me stories about, certain people up in Potter County who see mountain lions running around and things like that. And it just kind of got me thinking that, some of these things may be misreported sometimes. Some are probably actually something legitimately mysterious. So,
wow. Well, it sounds like we have very similar histories there, Andrew, and I think some of the other guests I've had on, it seems to always start when you're young, and of course, young men in particular are fascinated with monsters and dinosaurs and creepy crawlies and things, so it seems like it's something that just kind of sticks with us through life, although I guess most people don't pursue it with the vigor that you do. So you've grown up in kind of in the state of Pennsylvania, is that correct? Where have you lived in your life?
Pretty much always right here.
Yeah. So, you know your backyard. That's what I'm kind of angling at here. You know your turf, which is always a good thing as a researcher. So I imagine that you are very familiar with a very famous cryptid from the Northeast Coast. And, of course, everyone loves to talk about the Jersey Devil. It's one of the most popular and iconic legendary creatures that we have here in the Americas. I understand that's a real passion of yours. Tell us what you about some of the work you've done into the Jersey Devil and some of your thoughts on that particular cryptid.
Well, that also really goes back to when I was a kid, because that was really one of the first ones I remember reading about specifically was the Jersey Devil. And, I mean, the thing I read about it, they called it the Leeds Devil, which kind of a term they isn't really used for it that much anymore. It's been a while since I heard it, and you very rarely really hear it outside of New Jersey, honestly. But yeah, it's a lot of the sightings were, in 1909 in the winter, when it was all along the Delaware. There were a lot of sightings here in Pennsylvania of it then. Actually, I believe, of that whole week, I think the second sighting that week was in Pennsylvania. First, it appeared, I think the first was somewhere around Camden in New Jersey, and then it was in Bristol, Pennsylvania, which is in Bucks County, right along the Delaware.
So and right across the border there.
Yep. And it was, the Jersey Devil is really, I think, it's really complicated because over time, it's pretty much the name just gets applied to a lot of things, and I think a lot of them aren't really what we think of as a Jersey Devil. I mean, we usually think of the gargoyle dragon-looking thing. And a lot, there's sightings of what we figure would probably be Bigfoot and just regular mountain lions. And actually, there was even a few, especially early in that week in 1909, that actually almost seemed like they were sightings of UFOs or something more. Because it's when they described it, they talk about it had almost these like machine-like qualities to it. Certain sounds that it would make and ways it would move and things like that almost made it sound maybe possibly like it was more like a UFO at that time. Actually, then another segue into, you know, how I got into this in the first place is I read Mysterious America by Lauren Coleman back in the 80s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Classic.
And he mentioned a sighting that took place near Downingtown here in Pennsylvania. In the, I think it was in the chapter he had in there on the Jersey Devil. And so basically I was kind of hooked for years on like trying to find more information on what exactly got seen, because it wasn't a lot of detail in that like particular little part there. But yeah, I think the Jersey Devil is, I think it's probably actually what you would call it, like a actual zooform at this point, because it's so ingrained in the folklore and things like that. And I mean, if you go into New Jersey, the actual New Jersey stories of the Jersey Devil, they mention things like it's a portent of evil, and it sometimes it has control over the weather, and it sometimes appears in the company of a couple ghosts and things like that. And it's like they're giving it much more supernatural qualities than we usually think of.
So what you're saying is basically it's, you know, and to backtrack a little bit, you mentioned 1909, but of course there's this whole legend about the Leeds family and, you know, the Jersey Devil was essentially spawned. I mean, there's many different interpretations from what I understand, but the most popular one is probably that it was the 13th ill-begotten child of some woman, and that essentially when it was born, it sprouted wings and flew out the window. And so as you mentioned, it's kind of almost more of a superstition, right, where people kind of connected with a lot of these different spiritual beliefs and, you know, just urban legends. Is that accurate?
Yeah, for the most part. There are obviously, you know, legitimate sightings of something or other. But, yeah, for the most part, I think it's one thing that I did find when I was researching my stuff on Pennsylvania for the book that I thought was very, very interesting to me is that actually right over in, would be in Chester, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. which is right, it's right below Philadelphia, but there's a story of something called the Ape Boy of Chester.
Ooh,
which is, the story, it sounds to me a lot like the Jersey Devil story, because it's this kid was like really, really ugly and, you know, got basically nobody wanted anything to do with him, and he ran off into the swamp, and he basically over the years, because this was back pre-revolution, this supposedly happened, he's basically devolved into like almost a Bigfoot type thing, and he's living in the swamps there. And it's just, it seemed a lot to me to be almost like the Jersey Devil story in a lot of ways. Because you have, you know, a person who's like, becomes a monster, pretty much.
Hmm. Well, you heard it here, folks. The Ape Boy of Chester? I've never heard of
yep.
that. That's pretty weird stuff. So, give us kind of a description of what's kind of the composite description of the devil, Andrew. I know you mentioned that it's probably a catch-all name for different creatures, but we mentioned the wings. What other characteristics do people think of when they think of the Jersey Devil?
It's usually described as, there's that famous old picture that was in the newspaper. It's supposed to be has a dog's body. It usually has a reptilian tail. Sometimes it has a little fork on the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
And a horse's head and a long neck.
Mm-hmm.
And, the one that's shown in that famous picture that was in papers in Philadelphia, I think, was actually that animal wasn't described as having been very big at all, really. It was only supposed to be about 3 feet high, something like that. It wasn't very big at all. And another thing that gets described a lot is it has a clumsy sort of flight to it when it flies, which is a pretty common thing for these winged monsters, too. Talk about how they're kind of clumsy when they fly.
They're not aerodynamically inclined, right?
Yeah.
Huh, that's pretty cool stuff. Yeah, that's the, like you said, there was a famous sketch, and I guess it was based on an eyewitness description, the Nelson Evans, I believe is the gentleman's name.
Yeah. Right.
But then other people described something similar, as you mentioned. It's kind of a chimera. I mean, the only thing I can really equate it to, and I'm apparently this has been done long ago, but some of the Ramphorhynchus-type pterosaurs, the flying reptiles, had that long, kind of tail with a flange on the end. They did have bat-like wings and long necks, but that's kind of where the similarities end. And, the whole notion of a living pterosaur flying around Pennsylvania, New Jersey, I guess that's going to be a little bit difficult for people to swallow.
There was another possibility people had mentioned about hammerhead bats.
Talk about that.
One in Africa with
the
funky looking head, which really, if you think about it, kind of could look like a horse's head if you see it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, how exactly there would be a hammerhead bat flying around New Jersey in the winter of 1909, I really don't have any idea. But
Yeah, that's kind of far-fetched. Now, we've talked about on the show before, we've talked about, escaped animals, particularly with regard to, like, the Black Panther sightings. I guess it's feasibly possible that someone may have released an exotic hammerhead bat into the wild, but it wouldn't be able to survive, would it, in the climate of Pennsylvania? And isn't that a tropical animal, as far as you know? Or?
Yeah. It probably wouldn't be surviving very long, and that could maybe have something to do with why they mentioned the clumsy sort of flight to it, because it's, actually physically weak and dying. So it's kind of not be that agile. And now I do know one thing I would like to check out a little bit more. I don't think it's still there. But I did find newspaper articles from around the time mentioning that in Yardley, Pennsylvania, which is in Bucks County also, there was apparently, I don't really know what it was. It was some sort of, I kind of get the impression it was like an animal preserve or something like that, maybe. I just know I found an article where they had mentioned something, finding the tracks of something in the snow or whatever, and they said it might be an animal from Yardley. But I don't really know what exactly they meant by that. But I would like to look into that and see if what kind of animal they would have had there and if there's a possibility that maybe actually something would have escaped, because that would be kind of centrally located for most of the sighting.
Well, that's an interesting theory. Well, that's a pretty fascinating story. People frequently ask me about the Jersey Devil, and I tell them that I, you know, essentially think it's just kind of an urban legend. I mean, you know, we're talking about, now I understand there are occasionally still sightings here and there, but, you know, not with the frequency from which we get things like Bigfoot sightings, lake monster sightings and things like that. I guess they're kind of fleeting. But it is a great story, and it ties into, you know, a lot of the history of the area. Kind of on a related note, Andrew, is the Piasa of Illinois, which I guess also gets kind of connected in with some of the Thunderbird reports here and there. Can you tell us about the Piasa and the, you know, is there a similar legend from Illinois of kind of a flying demon-type monster?
Well, that is kind of a, it's kind of a problematic thing to me, really, that it really, to me, the fact that it, I don't know, just the fact that, like, a story has hung around so long is kind of, how do I want to say, I'm not really 100% glad that the story's been hanging around so long, because the thing is, it's like, it was discovered, you know, the rock painting near Alton was discovered when Marquette was going down the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote the description in his journal of it, and had, I think he had supposedly had a sketch of it in there too. But I just always found it funny, because it's like they talk about, you know, this Thunderbird type thing with wings and everything like that, but then yet it's like Marquette's description, he doesn't mention anything about wings on it. He just says it basically looks like, you know, the depictions of it usually look.
It's, yeah,
like, just minus the wings. And that was actually when I was doing stuff for the Cryptozoology Review. That was one of the things me and a few other people were looking into a lot, was trying to figure out what was actually going on, because they did find a map of the Mississippi that was drawn by the French, and it was in 1670s or something, so it was probably at the point when the original pictogram was still there. And that basically looked like the drawing looks like now, but it doesn't have the wings on it. And we were thinking that that would be, it's very common among a lot of the Native American tribes in the Northeast, is a water panther. And it looks almost like it will be a depiction of a water panther. And water panthers they're supposed to be like spirits that lived in the river that inhabited like regions of rapids. They usually painted or drew or carved whatever, something them on a cliff nearby. And they were supposed to be these things that lived in the water, and they had like almost a beaver-like tail, and they'd thrash their tail up and down, and that's like what made the rapids. And I think it seems that's what it actually was. Now, in 1832, I believe it was, there was a guy named John Russell, who was a minister out there.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote the story that everybody knows of it, with the Chief Watogo, who sacrificed himself to it so, you know, the Indians could kill it. He basically wrote that story, and he created that name for it, and that was the first mention of it as, like, a winged creature. And I just think a lot of the, like, longevity of the story probably has to do with the fact that all the copies of the picture really we have are later copies, and the original's been gone for 200 years now.
Right. They were doing some mining there or something, blowing up the cliffs, and they collapsed it, right?
Well, apparently by that point it wasn't in the best of shape anymore anyway. But, yeah. We kind of put the death knell on it. But, yeah, that just seems to me that's a thing that, because the articles we were looking at about where people had actually proposed this theory before about it being a water panther, those articles were written in, like, 1919. So this is a long, long time this has been around.
Right.
But it just seems, I don't know. It probably has to do with, there is a number of Thunderbird sightings along in that region along the Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, I don't know.
That's an interesting coincidence. Well, speaking of Thunderbird sightings, Illinois and, of course, other states such as Texas, where I live here, Alaska, have kind of a history of those, but Pennsylvania really has a very rich history of Thunderbird-type reports, particularly in sort of the Susquehanna River Valley of the northwest central region. Have you done any research into the Pennsylvania Thunderbirds, Andrew? And can you give us any information on that?
Yeah, I've looked around. Actually, that area where they're reported from is actually also, again, in a weird synchronicity thing, happens to be where I went to college. I went to college in Lock Haven, which is pretty much in the middle of where they see all these things. So, you know, that's right up there in the area. So I pretty much know what that area looks like. And I can say I don't doubt something to be there, because Clinton County, which is the one that Lock Haven is in, is the entire county, I think, is like probably 100 miles from end to end.
Mm-hmm.
Now, almost all the towns in Clinton County are this little five-mile band along the southern border of the county, and pretty much everything above there is West Virginia, basically.
The boonies.
Really... the same, yeah, same kind of territory. It's all hills and creeks and woods. And I would not doubt at all that there could be any number of things up there that would probably never get seen, because there's not much in the way of habitation up that way either. There's a couple towns here and there, but they're all along the river, along the Susquehanna. And once you get inland from the river, there's really nothing at all. So if anything was there, it'll probably be seen pretty rarely. I have looked around, and I've searched all I could. I haven't found very many. I found like one or two reports that I've never seen in books before, published in books and things. But, it seems pretty much all of the sightings have been, you know, published in books before and that. Now, it's interesting when you look at the descriptions that the people usually give of the Pennsylvania Thunderbirds, and they usually seem, almost when you take a composite of them, they almost sound like they're describing almost like a heron sort of thing, or heron or crane or something like that. And that would also tie in, because as you may know, a lot of the more recent sightings, they've been reporting like pterodactyl type things in Pennsylvania here a lot.
Yeah, it's weird.
And also, if you've seen a heron flying, you know, it really, really, I'd forgive somebody for calling that a pterodactyl, to be honest with you. I mean, when they have their wings all spread out, and they even have the little crest out of the back of the head like a pteranodon.
There are definitely some pterodactyl mimics out there. You know, as you mentioned, herons, certain storks, birds like that that just have kind of a very prehistoric look to them.
Yeah.
Well, that could explain some of them, yeah. I know from my research that, you know, and a lot of it's the same research you read, which is, you know, again, people like Lauren Coleman, Mark Hall, and so forth. You know, there are literally dozens of accounts of these Thunderbirds in Pennsylvania spanning over a century, and the descriptions, I guess they vary to some extent, but, you know, the classic image is, you know, basically like a large condor or raptor-type bird, something in very dark coloration.
Right.
I think that's the most common description, something like that.
Well, one thing about that that I did find interesting was that there was actually, it's kind of obscure information, honestly, but actually California condors were, in the Pleistocene, were actually native to New York State.
Really?
Even though, yeah. And that was another thing I was thinking about just yesterday that I wouldn't doubt at all. If there were some left, they could easily be there, because then if anybody would see them, you'd be like, oh, it's a big vulture. And it would... I always did have a kind of feeling that a lot of unknown animals, that what ones are out there, would probably be close enough to something that's there so that people could see it a lot more than maybe they necessarily realize. Just
don't
think
make
it's
a connection.
Something strange.
Yeah, got it.
Like if, you know, they see these condors, they just think it's a vulture. So we're not going to say anything about it. And once in a while, when someone sees one up close, hey, oh, that's not a vulture. So
now that's a great point. They have some similarities. Mm-hmm. And I was actually at the zoo last week and got up close to some of those Andean condors, and those are really very massive birds. Now they're certainly not man sized, but when you see that, you know, those that 10-foot wingspan, 10-11-foot wingspan unfurl before you, you know, someone would certainly, if they saw something like that in any situation in the wild, they would be, you know, taken back and could possibly describe it as a monster.
Yeah. And another thing I experience a lot is that when a bird is flying in the air, it's really, really hard to accurately say how big that bird is, because you got to factor in how exactly high up is it, and, you know, do all this complicated math in your head to figure out how big that bird really is. I always heard a lot of sightings of things, it's like, take about 3/4 of that size, and that might be about how big a bird you're actually looking at.
Mm.
The interesting thing is the Pennsylvania ones, a lot of them really aren't, like, disgustingly big. Like, some, you know, some thunderbirds, they say, oh, it's, you know, 75 feet across and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Pennsylvania ones, they usually say 16 to 18 feet, which is, like, it's big, but it's not, you know, unheard of big. And then if you take a 3/4 thing and you're dealing with maybe a bird that's 12 feet or so wingspan, that's, yeah, it's a pretty big bird, but it's not outside the realm of possibility at all.
Certainly not. And, you know, we should mention the teratorns, which were the ancestors of modern vultures and condors. And there is one North American species that had a wingspan approaching 20 feet. And I think it was like 18 feet, Aeolornis. So, like you said, I mean, it's certainly within the realm of possibility. We can't discount it. Andrew, let's kind of jump across the Atlantic Ocean here for a minute. Back in 2008, 2009, I was very fortunate to be able to travel to France and investigate the Beast of Gévaudan. And I know this is something you've been very interested in as well. It's a great story. Why don't you give us a little bit, just a brief background on the story and, you know, your thoughts on that particular case, which is, you know, from what I learned, is still a very famous and iconic legend in France and throughout Europe.
Yeah, it was 1764?
that's when it started.
That, first, and it was for a couple of years. It was up to like 1767, wasn't it?
Yeah, 3 years.
Or 1768, one
or
another.
Or so, roughly 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was some sort of large wolf or something. I don't know quite what it was. Some sort of canid, anyway. That was going around, basically just rampaging across the countryside. It killed, I think it was like up like 120 people or something like that over this
allegedly
period. A couple times had been claimed to be killed, and people had wolves that they, you know, they the King of France sent a wolf hunter down there to go after this thing, and he killed, I think he killed like a very really big wolf or something, but then the killings from this beast kept going on after that thing was already dead. So, and then supposedly you had the guy shot it with a silver bullet and killed it. And so that led into, you know, that it was a werewolf. Interesting thing about that is that when Chastel finally killed it, I'm trying to think where exactly I saw this. Because I'm really bad with this, where I remember I saw something, read something, and I have absolutely no idea where I read it.
You don't have to reference it exactly, but just give us kind of the gist of what was the concept that you learned about.
I think it was after Chastel killed it. They were taking it, parading it around, showing off the, oh, I finally killed this beast. And the reports I saw, some of them actually described something bipedal. Because I recall hearing that one of the theories that some people had was actually, it was a baboon, was one of the theories that they had.
Ooh, a baboon. And that would be weird.
Yeah, it would, but, I mean, as I'm sure you know also, baboons are fairly aggressive. I could see a baboon, I don't know about killing 120 people, but killing a lot of people. But, yeah, most of the descriptions have it as the quadrupedal canine of some sort.
Right, but potentially a werewolf, since it's walking around on its high legs in some accounts. That was the common belief at the time, right? Something like
that?
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Now, actually, the first article I even wrote was about the beast, and not only the beast, but other, throughout England and stuff, you have the cattle mutilation type cases, but where they actually see some sort of animal running around doing it. I was basically just writing about them. My idea was that the beast might have been maybe some sort of mustelid or something.
Mm.
I believe what I was going by was, because I remember you, when you went over there, you were looking, they had the records and things of the people that
got
killed by it and
everything. Yeah, we got to look at, death certificates and medical records, and of course it was a big deal, as you mentioned, the king got involved, and so there was a lot of documentation, and there was basically a mass hysteria going on because they couldn't stop it, so... just tons and tons of documentation, but you don't really know where any of that goes because, from what I learned, there were a lot of ulterior motives involved in the time. For example, this was right just prior to the French Revolution, so the natives
right.
were restless, so to speak. People were already kind of rising up against authority, and so you wonder if, to some extent, that these stories were embellished. For whatever reason, if the hierarchy was using fear to control the people, I mean, there's just so many theories.
Now the how the people were killed, didn't it tend to go after when it attacked people? Didn't it tend to go for their head a lot?
That's
their
true. A lot of people
were
apparently decapitated or disemboweled, one or the other.
I think that may have been what I heard, that
started me thinking about the Mustelid, because like a Wolverine, how it hunts, it'll be like up in the tree and it'll drop down a lot of times, and a lot of times it'll attack the head or the head and neck of something. And I think that might be what started giving me the idea. Honestly, I wrote the article, like I said, was the first thing I really wrote. I was only 19 when I wrote it, and I'm really not very happy with it. I might want to go back and still do something on it, but maybe try to rewrite it a little bit. And
You should definitely revisit it, Andrew. Well, let's talk about the you kind of mentioned some of the British legends. What about the demon dogs, the Black Shuck, and some of those phantom black devil dogs, I guess, whatever they call them in England. Is that something that you've looked into?
I enjoy the stories of them. A lot of the actual, like the main black dogs, like Shuck and all of them, and Barghest and all that, I don't really think are anything. But yeah, there are a few where, particularly back around the turn of the century, there were the turn. Well, I should specify, since it's not really that century anymore. The turn of the 1900s, around the late 1800s, early 1900s, there seemed to have been a lot of these things where there would be a what we would call like a cattle mutilation, but they would see some sort of thing walking, running around, or find the tracks of something. And actually, there was in Hexham, England, there was a big hunt in 1905 for some kind of a wolf, is what they ended up shooting. Now, of course, that's interesting because of the story of the Hexham Heads. That's just weird that it happens that this thing they were tracking was in almost the exact same region where they ended up finding the heads years later. And that had the wolfish sort of ghost associated with it. So that's interesting, but I don't know what it means. But it's an interesting coincidence, but yeah. And, well, you know, in the CFZ, we have a lot of people in England, obviously, and they've written about a lot of these cases where they shoot the they found a jackal in, outside of, not too far outside of London, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. So, I'm not really 100% sure. I think maybe a lot of these probably were canines of some sort, were probably wolves. To go back to the Beast of Jabal Don a minute, something I just remembered. Actually, around that time period, there were a lot of, basically, he wasn't in an isolated incident. There were packs of marauding wolves and things all along the border, like between France and Germany.
Right.
Like, all around
very
that time
region.
Period.
I'm sorry. I was just saying I've been there. It's a very, when you think of France, you don't think of this. It's kind of a mountainous, small mountainous region with a lot of forests and things.
I'll bet it was upwards of like a dozen separate places that in the 1760s had these same sorts of things going on, not to that magnitude or anything, but the same sort of incident was going on.
Hmm.
So kind of gets you into the idea of, was there something, I don't know, something more widespread going on? Now, I know when you went over there about the hyena-type hypothesis, that I found when I was working on this, what was really interesting was there was a cave painting that was actually, I think it might have been like one province over, but it was basically in the same area,
mm-hmm.
that depicted a cave hyena.
So it's kind of getting you into the idea that, you know, cave hyenas were in that region of France. So,
yeah, absolutely, and that was one point that I was trying to emphasize. Of course, I didn't have final control over the editing and how the show turned out, but you know, they favored the idea of the escaped hyena or the menagerie type hyena. But I mean, these prehistoric cave hyenas, and they found many of these fossils throughout France. These things were massive. I mean, you think of a normal spotted hyena is already a pretty big animal and very vicious, I might add. But if you think about the cave hyenas, which lived during the Ice Age, if some of those things had survived, I mean, you're talking about a veritable monster there, because that thing could easily kill many, many people and would not be stopped. And they do somewhat resemble wolves. I mean, at least if you're running away from it, you might.
Yeah, if you're not not really paying too much attention to what it actually looks like.
Andrew, I think we should make a little clarification here because, you know, cryptozoology is kind of an evolving field, and it's reaching into all these different areas. And, of course, you and I belong to the Center for Fortean Zoology, and you mentioned the word zooform earlier. You know, so for the traditional cryptozoologists that typically only think of Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, just give us a brief description of zooform and why some of us that are interested in cryptozoology investigate these really weird creatures that sometimes lend a little bit more towards mythology and superstition as opposed to, you know, real animals.
Well, a really good example of what that would be Mothman, for instance. That is like a lot of... It seemed that there was a lot more going on than just some sort of bird flying around there. Because you get into all the... There's UFO stuff going on and, you know, phone calls from mysterious people in the middle of the night and things like that. And getting in, you know, into all kinds of other things. It's really... This whole sort of idea of kind of more supernatural kind of... What most people would call a cryptid, but is like really maybe not quite 100% a cryptid, because I mean, a better example to define it would be like when we were talking about the Jersey Devil. I think the Jersey Devil, this is kind of what's going on. It's like an archetypal thing in folklore that it's been hanging around for generations and generations and generations, and it's maybe in some way people kind of created some sort of phantom sort of thing that people see once in a while, but it's kind of not really there.
Kind of like an apparition or a manifestation as opposed to a living, breathing animal or biological thing.
Right. And then it's, you know, it gets into the things of, well, that, you know, some things are really, really hard to find, and you're never going to find the Jersey Devil because technically he's not actually there. I don't know. It's kind of really hard. It's a really hard concept sometimes to really wrap your head around, figuring out how exactly these things exist and stuff. But it's an interesting idea.
It is, and it definitely it requires a broader view or scope of the universe beyond just physical and looking to the metaphysical. And I know some cryptozoologists are uncomfortable. The old guard, as I call them, are uncomfortable with some of these. But, you know, going back to Lauren, I mean, Lauren Coleman started writing about things like Mothman and stuff back in the 70s, the Dover Demons. So he was, you know, Ted Holliday, and of course, people like John Downs continue the tradition today. So, I mean, there is some overlap there. And, you know, in some cases, as you mentioned earlier, they may in fact be simply misidentifications of real animals, and people are putting or sort of endowing them with supernatural attributes. So who knows?
Yeah.
Well, we're getting close to the end here, Andrew. Time flies, man. I wish we could. I wanted to ask you real quick. I wanted to just do a brief couple of minutes here on Monty the Monster. I found that when I was kind of researching you, and I thought that was something cool that I had never heard about. What is Monty the Monster?
Okay. That was actually, I'm thinking when the case I alluded to earlier where Lauren Coleman said about this man-beast thing around Downingtown, I'm thinking that might be relevant to Monty the Monster. Monty the Monster was right south of Pottstown in Pennsylvania. It was, he was a complicated sort of thing. It was, basically, it seems the way it kind of started was kids were walking home from school and heard something in the woods and saw some creature running around, and it started this whole mass hysteria thing, basically, where people would go out hunting Monty the Monster, and they ended up actually, at some point, they were more dangerous than whatever they were hunting was, because there were two or three incidents where people ended up shooting other people, and there were car wrecks going on of people that were looking for it and thought it was jumping out of the woods at them, and they veered off and smashed into a tree, and all kind of interesting stuff. Now, that said, though, there did seem to actually be something there, because I'm aware of a couple times people actually did say they saw it. Now, the only problem is the newspapers didn't really take the story very seriously, I don't think, and they didn't really do a good job of giving you even a passable description of what the heck it was. It sounded to me almost like some sort of maybe a mountain lion sort of thing, some sort of cat or something. They talk about how it screamed and it jumped around and this massive jumping ability it had, and supposedly had a really big tail. Now, that actually is interesting, because when I, in my Pennsylvania book, I'm talking about Monty the Monster, and then since then I've basically kept researching, and I found a lot of stories from that same general area of the state of things that really kind of sound sort of the same. You have these jumping things that scream and hop around, and it's really, really odd. I don't really know what's going on. Now, Monty the Monster was in 1945, and then the sightings, main body of sightings seemed to be in the 30s and 40s, which, being limited like that, it kind of gives more the impression that there actually was something there. Now, there was a sighting which Lauren posted on Cryptomundo, I think. The one in, it was in Coatesville. There was a guy who was out farming, and something ran by him, and he said it screamed. What was it? How did he describe it? It was a really neat description. It screamed like two women or something like that. I don't know. But that, I found articles where people were saying that was what they called a roof rabbit, which is the kind of really deceiving name, because what they're talking about is basically a mountain lion. I don't quite know why they would start calling it a roof rabbit, but whatever.
That's weird. Well, Andrew, sorry, we got to wrap it up here, brother. Time flies, but they like me to get out a little early, so the next guest has time to set up. But, man, you have been an awesome guest, brother. Very knowledgeable, very informative. Love to get you back on sometime so we can talk about Maryland's Goat Man and some of those other kind of weird man beasts and legends that you have up in Pennsylvania and Maryland. But before we go, just real quick, where can, go ahead and take an opportunity to plug your book. Please feel free to give out a website, or if there's a place where people can get in touch with you to learn more about your research.
Okay,
like I said, I Mysterious Pennsylvania should be out very shortly. I don't know. I'm not sure exactly when. I'm working on one on Maryland. I would like to do something at some point on the Kissing Bug stories from the 1890s, because not much work has ever been done on them, and there's a lot to be found. Basically, people can get a hold of me on, I'm on Facebook. I have a blog at Masks of Mistingua. it's a very strange name, but it makes sense. No way. But that's maskasofmesingw.blogspot.com.
Well, awesome, Andrew.
Well,
once again, we appreciate you coming on, and thanks again, Andrew Gable, our guest this evening, talking about all kinds of weird cryptids. I just want to remind you, we'll be back here again in 2 weeks on liveparanormal.com with another episode of Search for Hidden Beasts. So with that being said, this is Ken Gerhard, along with Andrew Gable, thanking you for listening in and reminding you to keep up the search for hidden beasts.